Welcome back to Run the List, a medical education podcast in partnership with McGraw-Hill Medical. Our hosts are Dr. Naveen Kumar, Dr. Walker Redd, Dr. Emily Gutowski, Dr. Joy Sao, and myself, Blake Smith. As a quick disclaimer, this podcast is meant for informational and educational purposes only and should not be understood as medical advice under any circumstances.
Welcome back to Run the List. We're here with another episode from our infectious disease block, and today we'll be talking about HIV. My name's Emily Gutowski, and I'm here with Dr. Michelle Cespedes. Dr. C, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I am an infectious disease specialist here at Mount Sinai. I'm the director of the inpatient HIV service, but also the co-director of our research unit here at Mount Sinai as well. So I have a special interest in HIV prevention and also the inclusion of subpopulations that are disproportionately affected by HIV.
Wonderful. We're so happy to have you. Thanks for joining us. So without further ado, let's go ahead and run the list. We have a 27-year-old male with no prior medical history, and he's coming to urgent care for fever, fatigue, and muscle aches, as well as a sore throat. This all started a couple days ago, and it's been getting worse. He actually took an at-home COVID test, which was negative. He says he's had no recent travel, but does have a new male sexual partner. On exam, he has cervical and axillary lymphadenopathy, as well as a faint maculopapular rash over his neck. Thinking about this case, we have a pretty wide differential, but since there's really a lot to talk about in this episode, we're just going to go ahead and jump to his lab tests, which show a positive HIV test with a viral load of 2 million. So firstly, Dr. Cespedes, how do you conceptualize HIV, especially when you're explaining this disease to new patients?
So when someone's newly diagnosed, one of the first things I do is try to dispel some old myths and misconceptions people may have of HIV. I really try to explain to them how their prognosis can be really quite good if they take care of themselves and really follow the main objective of remaining undetectable, or meaning such a low viral load that we won't be able to detect it. It protects their long-term health and can prevent them from transmitting the virus to other people sexually. The other things I talk about is really how easy, how far kind of medicine has come and the science of how to treat HIV. We're now to the point where we have several one pill, once a day regimens and some newly FDA approved regimens that are injectables. So long acting options. Where we're to the point now where we can give injections once every 2 months. So big strides really decrease the amount of toxicity associated with treatment, and incredible strides in projecting the lifespan and quality of life of people who are diagnosed with HIV if they remain in care.
Great. So a heavy dose of reassurance and really explaining to the patients exactly what this diagnosis means.
Correct.
So thinking about what may have led to this patient acquiring HIV, what are some of the high-risk behaviors that we tend to think about that predispose patients to getting HIV?
Because we know HIV is a virus that is transmitted through blood, exchange of bodily fluids, mainly sex acts, and perinatal transmission, of course, some of the main risk factors are any risky sex behaviors that would actually increase that risk of transmission. But one of the things I actually stress to both, you know, residents and students and even patients, especially patients who are maybe at high risk, is that it might not necessarily be the type of sex act, but if there's a lot of HIV in the particular population, let's say, for instance, if you live in a zip code where there's a lot of HIV, even if you do not use IV drugs or as a man who has sex with men, you would actually be more at risk technically because there's just more HIV where you are. So certain subpopulations, your risk factor may be your zip code in and of itself. Drug use, of course. And I think we, you know, by definition, always think of injection drug use. But even drugs that are not injectable can increase risk. If, let's say, people have sex in exchange for drugs, or, you know, sex in exchange for safe housing or food or shelter. A third risk factor that I like to tell people to be mindful of is concurrent partnerships. So really knowing the HIV status of any sexual partners and whether or not any of the your partners are involved with anyone else. So know your status and know your status often if you start a new relationship.
Great. So these are all really important questions to ask about. And just keeping in mind that These might be uncomfortable questions for us as providers to ask our patients, especially, you know, in the hospital setting where maybe we're meeting these patients for the first time. But we have to just really remember that these are important and we're keeping in mind the health of our patients when we're asking them. So in this case, we've diagnosed our patient with HIV. What are our next steps in terms of thinking about treatment for him?
So in terms of thinking of treatment, one of the things that we do just as part of primary care of the HIV patient is, depending on what test was sent, if he had a rapid test to diagnose his HIV, first actually confirming that it really is HIV, that it wasn't a false positive test, but we know by that high viral load that he truly is infected. We want to know if there are any other infections that kind of travel the same way HIV does, so testing for any other STIs, but also including his hepatitis A, B, and C status. If he needs vaccines for A and B, we would give that. And C, we want to know his hepatitis C status, but especially for hepatitis B, because several of the HIV medicines actually also treat hepatitis B. So that would make treatment decisions different for us, or making sure that we would treat both of them at once. Sending his resistance genotype so that we know which medicines work best for him. That wouldn't slow us down from starting medicines as soon as possible. That answer comes back in about 2 weeks or so. But the data actually shows the sooner we start HIV medicines, you know, if the patient is able to and can follow up, the better. And making sure there are any of the other things that we can prevent or that are known to cause more harm in HIV as we do screening for those. So confirming the HIV, doing resistance panel testing, preventing anything that we can, knowing there are hepatitis, serologies, you know, age-appropriate screening, and also, you know, their baseline CD4, LFTs, comprehensive, and a CBC.
Got it. So we do all of these things for our patient at this appointment. And moving on to the mini epilogue for him, he started on Biktarvy.
Okay.
He does attend the first couple of months of follow-up, but then unfortunately he's lost to follow-up and we don't see him for 5 years. So we're going to zoom ahead 5 years later. This is now a 32-year-old gentleman. He's coming to the hospital now with shortness of breath and fever. He tells you that he's not taking any medications. He's febrile and tachypneic, and his exam is notable for bilateral crackles on his lung exam, as well as oropharyngeal thrush. His CD4 count is 65 and his HIV viral load is 80,000. So thinking about the diagnostic workup in someone like this patient, beyond what we might expect in someone who's immunocompetent, what might be in our differential diagnosis based on his CD4 count? And how do we kind of factor in CD4 count versus viral load when thinking about these patients?
So the fact that his CD4 is under 200 means that he's at risk for opportunistic infections, really from organisms that we come into contact with all the time, you know, things that we breathe in and dirt and, you know, really just parasites in our water and everything of the sort. But his immune system really doesn't have enough power to fight those. So under 200, we think of opportunistic infections. And even because of how low he is, he's actually 65. So when you're below that 100, close to CD4 count of 50 or lower, they're even more rare opportunistic infections that we would start to see crop up then. Because his seems to be limited to lungs, or, you know, based on his exam, and I think you said his chest x-ray findings as well, the most common pulmonary infections for someone with a CD4 count lower than 200 would be a bacterial pneumonia that anyone could get, but also PCP pneumonia. So that's probably one of the more common OIs that we see at baseline. His being so low, you might think of some of the odd fungal pneumonias or aspergillus, or for him, TB, of course. Hopefully we had information about his TB status when we first met him 5 years ago. But one of the other things I would want to get more information on is kind of what the reasons were that he's been lost to care for the last few years. Are there any competing priorities? Is it active drug use? Was he incarcerated? Did he move? Was it insurance issues, immigration issues? What are the things that we may be able to help, not just as medical professionals, but even through our psychology services, harm reduction services, or maybe even just a great social worker and insurance to help keep him in care?
Okay, all great things to think about. So just thinking about this history, when he does first come to the hospital, when we do have a patient who has HIV, what are some of the most important questions to ask upfront? I know asking about a history of opportunistic infections or OIs is important. Is there anything else that we should always be asking every single time we have an HIV patient?
For him in particular, especially because I know how low his CD4 count is, I want to know if he's been on medications and if he's recently started or restarted medicines. You know, we're always concerned about the entity called IRS, immune reconstitution syndrome. So let's say he's been off medicines for several years, he was doing okay, but he went to some other clinic and actually was started on HIV medicines just 4 weeks ago. So this actually might be a presentation of IRS, meaning he wasn't sick or his body didn't have problems or didn't recognize the PCP before then, but now that his T cells are coming up even just a little bit, he can have a recrudescence or a worsening presentation of an infection that was either previously treated or, you know, couldn't manifest any symptoms at all. So it makes a difference if someone has actually recently started medicines and they're getting sick, or if they're sick first and not on medicines. If I treat an opportunistic infection in the hospital and they have not been on medicines, I usually wait about 2 weeks or so of just trying to treat the opportunistic infection itself before restarting the HIV medicines. What I want to do is kill as many organisms as possible so that if their body or their immune system does get stronger, it's really not being overly stimulated by, you know, an excessive disease or organism burden. On the other hand, if he is developing symptoms after being on HIV medicines for about 6 weeks or so, I treat the OI, but I actually would preferably not stop his HIV medicines. If someone has IRS, you know, the thing that they need the most is probably getting their immune system back. So it's probably best not to stop and start and really kind of treat through the IRS. Maybe give them more steroids or try to mitigate their immune response that's causing them more trouble while treating the OI. So in general, if they're not on meds, treat the OI first for 2 weeks, then start HIV medicines. If they're already on HIV medicines, try your best to continue those as well while you're treating the OI.
So let's just change the question a little bit and assume that this patient actually has been taking his medications and has well-controlled HIV with an undetectable viral load. Suppose he came in with the same sorts of symptoms. Do we typically treat these patients who have undetectable viral loads the same way we would any sort of immunocompetent person?
So for me, I actually take a look more at what their CD4 count is. Anyone who's actually been on service with me knows that, you know, usually after the age, one of the first things I want to know is what's the CD4 count, right? It makes me think of things in a different way. If he presents with a cough, pneumonia, chest x-ray findings, and his CD4 is 400, I think of it differently than if his CD4 is 50. So just as, you know, all humans can, you can have a pneumonia with a normal immune system. But I would think more, especially this time of year, I would think COVID, I would think some of the respiratory viruses or a post-flu bacterial pneumonia. If he had a high CD4 count. If he has a lower CD4 count, I think of all those things, but put opportunistic infections higher up on my list. So sometimes the viral load, not so much. A viral load kind of can tell me the burden on his immune system, or if he has a fever too, is that from the untreated HIV or the infection? But the CD4 really makes me think differently about how I approach or treat, or what's more common to be causing this presentation.
Okay, so we will always make sure that CD4 is one of the first tests that we get on these patients when they come into the hospital. Just to move to a related but sort of side question, can you tell us a little bit about PrEP and PEP, which stand for pre-exposure prophylaxis and post-exposure prophylaxis specifically against HIV?
Okay, so post-exposure prophylaxis, PEP, has been around for 30 some odd years now. And this is really the principle. If especially a healthcare worker or if someone else gets exposed to a large volume of HIV in the workplace, let's say, you know, by a dirty needle or a needle that was known to be used on an HIV infected person, or for what we call non-occupational exposures, really usually sexual assaults or scratch or impaled by broken glass, let's say, in hospital medical waste or something of the sort. The principle is that we know from animal studies that if we give HIV medicines, even after HIV has entered the body, if we give it soon enough after that accident or incident, that we can actually prevent HIV from being incorporated into the body and actually setting up its, you know, essentially its life cycle. So even if HIV is in the body, if I have HIV medicines, following it closely, it can prevent HIV replication and truly establishing a true infection. The data has shown that the sooner that happens, the better. So especially in the hospital where we have the ER is always open or we'll have occupational health, it's always best to start post-exposure prophylaxis within the first 2 hours of an exposure or high-risk exposure. But there's benefit even up to 3 days. So usually 72 hours is our cutoff for really saying there's a benefit of preventing HIV. After more than 3 days, there's actually starting to be more risk of taking the medicines than the likelihood that taking the HIV medicines for 4 weeks would prevent infection if you had a large enough inoculation. So really the most important thing for post-exposure prophylaxis is to get it in your mouth as soon as possible after an exposure. So now if you kind of extrapolate that, the sooner I have medicine on board, the better. If I get infected with HIV or come into contact with HIV, wouldn't it even be better if I had some of that medicine in my blood already? So essentially the principle behind pre-exposure prophylaxis, you know, we can't anticipate an accident. But if you can anticipate that you engage in high-risk behavior or intend to, or you're just in a community with, you know, such a high presence that it is likely that you will come into contact with HIV, you can actually prevent HIV by already having the HIV medicines in your bloodstream before the HIV gets into your body. So the principle behind pre-exposure prophylaxis is to already have adequate blood levels of the medicine that will prevent HIV from replicating. It turns out for post-exposure, we actually do three medicines similar to how we do most treatment. But for pre-exposure, we found that you can actually have just two medicines that are highly effective. So we have two options for 2-in-1 tablets that can be used for pre-exposure prophylaxis.
That was great. Thank you so much for taking us through that. So as we start to wrap up this episode, are there any clinical pearls that you want to leave our listeners with about caring for patients with HIV?
So I would say some of the clinical pearls that I always want to make sure people are aware of is that both doctors and patients have misconceptions about who's at risk for HIV. So one of the things that we can do just as, you know, good doctors is to make sure that we offer everyone HIV testing, even if you sprain your ankle in the ER, you know, oh, by the way, we happen to have rapid tests. Have you ever been tested? Do you know your status? Do you know about PrEP? So, kind of being mindful of our misconceptions and offering everyone everything. Learning to take a good exam, being thorough, even if it's with difficult questions or uncomfortable things or sexual history. Really getting at risk factors. Oftentimes, I don't think we are comfortable with asking about sexual risk factors and illicit drug use. And third, knowing about PrEP, making sure that people know PrEP isn't just not just for those people, but making sure that we let everyone know that there is an option to protect yourself from HIV. And lastly, remembering that HIV in and of itself is a chronic disease, a manageable chronic disease that really has excellent outcomes if we can get people to make sure they know their status. If they're negative, keep them negative. And if they're positive, get them on HIV medicine so that they can protect their own health and prevent transmission to other people.
Dr. Cespedes, this has been such an informative episode, and I know it will help us all care for our patients much better. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invite. And please don't hesitate to invite me back as needed.
We will. Thank you.
Thank you.